Welcome to The Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by DragonMount.com.
The Wheel of Time is an epic fantasy series created by Robert Jordan.
At its conclusion, the series will consist of 14 novels and one prequel novel.
Sadly, Robert Jordan did not live to see his work complete.
Brandon Sanderson, appointed by Mr. Jordan's widow, Harriet Rigney, will complete the series with the novels The Gathering Storm, Towers of Midnight, and A Memory of Light, based on the notes left by Mr. Jordan.
This podcast is dedicated to discussing and enjoying the monumental work of fiction that is The Wheel of Time.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by DragonMount.com. I, of course, am Andrew Gellos, and with us this week is Virginia.
Hi, Andrew. It's great to be here again, and with us also for this episode is Spencer. Hey, Spencer.
Hi, everyone. How you doing?
I'm only filled with all this ridiculous jocularity because of the new release of the cover at this moment in time of the Towers of Midnight. And
yes.
I'm like, it's just filled me with joy and levity and various other bizarre feelings.
Yes. Okay. All right. As Virginia mentioned in her fits of hysteria, the news released, the Wheel of Time news, Watch You Should Know, released most recently before we started recording this podcast, is that Tor Books has announced the release date for the Towers of Midnight. So, Andrew, tell us what we should know.
Thank you, Spencer. Yes, Tor Books has announced that October 26th, 2010, will be the release date for Towers of Midnight, the penultimate 13th novel in the Wheel of Time series. In addition to this, on DragonMount.com, there was a dust jacket description of the book's plot. Warning, and this is true with all of the podcast, there are spoilers contained herein. The last battle has started. The seals on the Dark One's prison are crumbling. The pattern itself is unraveling, and the armies of the shadow have begun to boil out of the blight. The sun has begun to set upon the Third Age. Perrin Ibarra is now haunted by specters from his past. Waycloak, a slayer of wolves, and the responsibility of leadership. All the while, an unseen foe is slowly pulling a noose tight around his neck. To prevail, he must seek answers in Tel Aranriad and find a way, at long last, to master the wolf within him or lose himself to it forever. Meanwhile, Matrim Cawthon prepares for the most difficult challenge of his life. Creatures beyond the stone gateways, the Aelfin and the Eelfin, have confused him, haunted him, and left him hanged, his memory stuffed with bits and pieces of other men's lives. He had hoped that his last confrontation with them would be the end of it, but the wheel weaves as the wheel wills. The time is coming when he will have to dance with the snakes and the foxes, playing a game that cannot be won. The Tower of Genji awaits, and its secrets will reveal the fate of a friend long lost. This penultimate novel of Robert Jordan's number one New York Times best-selling series, the second of three based on materials he left behind when he died in 2007, brings dramatic and compelling developments to many threads in the pattern. The end draws near. Dove ande, se tovia sagain. It's time to toss the dice.
Ooh, I got chills. Oh, my goodness, I can't wait.
Oh, man.
October, hurry up.
Yeah.
It should also be noted that at the time of this recording, there are covers for both United Kingdom's and the U.S. releases of the cover art. Unfortunately, it makes a very strong note that the U.S. book cover that is currently shown is a temporary mock-up and not the final version of the cover, for which I, amongst many others that I have spoken to, say thank you.
I don't understand.
Please don't leave
why,
it anything similar.
No, I don't understand why Darryl Sweet would bother to complete a painting like that when it's got so many obvious glaring flaws. For one thing, Matt holding a halberd and modified halberd instead of his Ashandarai, and wearing a headband so he has been fused with Perrin somehow. And a typo, as if that weren't enough. But I'm still all excited about it, although I do have to say I have got to stop testing these Tarangrio when other people are around. It's too embarrassing.
Virginia, really? Yes, for those of you who may not have seen this, I'm not sure if it's the original cover, but this released version that they have on Dragonmount.com right now, it shows three persons standing in front of a reflective surface, which we can assume to be the Tower of Genji. The one in the middle is, we can assume to be Matt, because he's holding something that, I guess, I guess is supposed to be the Ashadari. It's gold-plated, and like Virginia says, it looks like a halberd. To the left side of Matt, on his right hand, is an elderly gentleman dressed in blue carrying a staff, which I hope is supposed to be Tom, just based mostly on his mustache, which is similar to what has been drawn on Tom in previous books. And then there's a third character who has their back facing towards us, who is drawing on this reflective surface what appears to be a triangle with a, rather than a straight line, a curved line at the bottom, dressed in purple and tan, about the same size as Matt. However, there is not a gray hair to be found on their head. They are standing straight. So we're not sure if it's Noel or Oliver or some amalgamation of the two, because it's not either one of them.
No, it's me. I'm telling you.
Some other character who we don't know about anymore. We haven't learned of yet.
It's me. I always wear purple, so unquestionably I'm getting a part in this book.
Oh. Okay.
Oh, I wish.
That works.
Yeah, probably a little too masculine to be me, but then, you know, it is a Daryl Street cover.
Is it still possible to buy a character in the book from Brandon? I don't know if he's still doing that.
Well, was he ever actually selling them? I thought it was a donation to charity that got you that.
Yeah, it's a donation to charity, which, you know. Proceeds from it. But I didn't
get any part in the book that I know of. Yeah. I made a donation. I played the game. The contest.
I don't even know what game it is.
It was a contest. So you made a donation. You got an entry. You got an entry into the drawing, and there was supposed to be just a few people getting the thing, but then lots and lots of people got their names mentioned. And nobody said if I was one, though.
Yeah, well, if you're going into a drawing and he has to pick him out And quite honestly, I love you, Virginia, but your name just doesn't quite mesh into the whole Wheel of Time world.
Oh, he changed the names for people, and some people with names even more pedestrian than mine had their names suitably modified. And he would put it on his Facebook page there for a while. He would go like, Nathan Jackson, you're a warder, and you know, XYZ, you're a something, but you're not human, you know. He had all these cool little teasers on there, but
And I saw at least.
I didn't get one.
Yeah, I saw at one point in time that our fellow podcaster Amir, I think, got one, didn't he?
Yeah, Amir, he did. He's in there. I'm devastated. I'm not in there.
You know what he's saving you for, Virginia? He's saving you until a memory of light, and then he's going to have you come out for some reason sometime in the old tongue, say, may the light illumine you and bring you joy.
Thereby wrapping up all of his promises to me in one fell swoop.
Just for you.
Yep. Brandon promised me before the last book came out, The Gathering Storm, that he would try to include a way to say may the light illumine you or walk in the light in the old tongue, because at this moment in time nobody that I know knows how to say anything about the light in the old tongue. So I thought that would be a nice little addition, but I think he forgot, to be honest with you. I have it on it's in posterity, though. It's in the Brandon podcast interview that we did in 2008. I have records. I have blackmail. Unfortunately, I think he's immune. I think he has an anti-blackmail Tarangrio.
Well, Well, when we get our next interview with him, which we will get another one in the future, if for the release, if no other time, but we'll have to make sure to bug him about it and see what he says.
Well, he's got two or three books wrapped up. There aren't many chances left.
Yes, but he's got the whole last battle left to go, and if that thing fits into, if that's going to fill a whole book, then there's time for plenty in there.
Okay. I don't want it to end, though. I want the end to come because I want to know, but I don't want it to end.
Oh, we'll still have plenty to talk about. I guarantee it.
Oh, I know, but still. And think of this. I mean, Andrew Spencer, think of this. We're getting a book in a year. 1 year from the last one.
Wow.
That's pretty astonishing.
How many years would this have been?
It'll be 23 years between the release of Eye of the World and the release of A Gathering Storm.
What was the shortest time between any of RJ's later books? 2 years?
I think. I'm not positive. I started reading recently, but I think from what I've seen before that there was one point where he actually had two released in the same year, but I could be completely off my rocker.
Well, I think he had the first five or six already written when they started being released, pretty much. And so those came out pretty quick, but I'm talking about like after, say, you know, Lord of Chaos or something like that. I think they slowed down dramatically. God, when did Path of Daggers come out? 2000, 99, 2000, something like that?
The first editions.
I have one here somewhere.
The Eye of the World, January 15th, 1990. Great Hunt, November 15th, 1990. Dragon Reborn, October 15th, 1991. Shadow Rising, September 15th, 1992. Fires of Heaven, October 15th, 1993. Lord of Chaos, October 15th, 1994. Crown of Swords, May 15th, 1996. Path of Daggers, October 20th, 1998. Winter's Heart, November 7th, 2000. Crossroads of Twilight, January 7th, 2003. Knife of Dreams, October 11th, 2005. The Gathering Storm, October 27th, 2009. Powers of Midnight will be released October 26th, 2010.
Wow. Yeah, I knew they started to slow down after Lord of Chaos. That was what I remembered. I was saying Path of Daggers, but my brain was envisioning Winter's Heart because I can remember distinctly exactly. It's sort of like, you know, 9/11. I remember exactly where I was when I got it and sat down to read it and everything. I remember the restaurant where I took the book and ensconced myself in a corner with some sushi and said, now, another book. Boy, oh boy.
Well, going back into the blurb on the dust jacket, there's this one sentence that will really lead in very well into our topic for tonight, and that's in the paragraph talking about Matt. It says, the Tower of Genji awaits, and its secrets will reveal the fate of a friend long lost. And so this episode, we're actually going to discuss Moraine, one of the most missed characters in the entire Wheel of Time. I mean, what was it that you were saying just repeatedly after you read The Gathering Storm, Virginia?
I thought we were going to go to the Tower of Genji in that book. Where's Moraine? Yeah, I whined about that a lot.
Yeah, here, just a second. Let me refresh your memory just because.
Oh, God, here it comes, the blackmail.
I'm going to sit here and say 1,000 times in this episode, I want Moraine back. I want Moraine back. I want her back. I want Moraine. I was completely disgruntled that she wasn't in The Gathering Storm. It's not fair, I tell you. It's not fair. I want Moraine back.
I'm going to have to be very careful what I say around you, Spencer. You're entirely too good at dredging up these quotes. Oh, that's, yeah, well, I'm still disgruntled. Want. I want Moraine back. Yeah. I really do.
No,
well, I'm going to venture to say that, you know, as Brandon talked about narrative debt, you know, when a writer mentions a certain thing so much, he builds up narrative debt. When you put the bloody event on the cover of the Bleeding Book, that is beyond narrative debt. If there is no Tower of Genji rescue in this book, I am going to go crazy on Brandon. I will seriously stalk him.
Until I
get an answer.
Yeah, that's gonna be the scene that he decided to paint here is Matt and Tom and this unknown third person get to the Tower of Genji and they start drawing the symbol and then Matt gets cold feet and leaves.
Oh, God. I'm not a hero, see ya.
No, Moraine, I have to say, and I actually did before we started recording, Moraine is one of the cornerstone characters of the series, which is amazing despite the fact that she hasn't been in 80% of the series. I am somewhat in awe and somewhat perplexed by how important Moraine has become. We've speculated hundreds of different theories on Moraine's importance in coming back from the Tower of Genji. We know from Min's viewings that Rand can't succeed without her. And, you know, there's been a lot of theories floated. There's been, you know, thoughts that maybe Lanfear is so much weaker now with Sindane because the Finns siphoned off some of her power to give to Moraine. And in my mind, that doesn't make sense because when we first meet Moraine, you know, in the first two books, she mentions, you know, four, five, six, I don't know how many times, that Egwene and Nynaeve and Elaine are all going to be stronger than her. We have one powerhouses. We've got tons of them now.
Yeah.
We don't need Moraine to be stronger. You know, a lot of people have said she's going to bring back knowledge, and I kind of wonder, what kind of knowledge would the Finns actually have? You know, I've started developing a theory that the reason Rand can't win if Moraine isn't there is more tied to the fact that despite that she wasn't the first person or first woman to die as the result of him, she tops the list for Rand. She is the first name on Rand's list, and even his epiphany isn't going to change the guilt that he has felt over all of these women who have died because of him. And I kind of have to feel that while she may bring back some knowledge, her presence is possibly going to lift from him at least some of the emotional burden he still is carrying with him that is still blocking his access to just living and existing and fighting the last battle because it needs to be fought, but not being an automaton while doing it.
Yeah, I have to agree. I have to agree with that. I think that not only did she die because of him, but she sacrificed herself for him. And that has really weighed heavily on his mind. I don't think there's any other death that even affected him as much, except possibly the leakage of the death of Elaenia to Lucerin. And I think he's kind of tied a lot of that together in his mind. I mean, I don't ever think there's going to be that relationship between Rand and Moraine. For one thing, she saw that when she went through the rings in Rudian and knew it would lead to disaster. But she's very important to Rand on a lot of different levels. And I think I am one of the proponents of the fact that she'll bring back some knowledge or gift or, you know, weapon of the One Power, Tarangriel, or something of that nature that will be instrumental in helping Rand to win the last battle, but just her mere presence alone has got to be a big plus for him.
Well, yeah, you know, you look back in the books, and it was after Moraine came, after Moraine left, that we got Cad Swanee to come in, and she has never been as good at dealing with Rand as Moraine was, even after Rand got put all these stipulations on her, either in Carheon, I can't remember if it was after they'd gotten into Carheon or while they were in the Waste. But she has always been better at communicating with Rand and gently leading him where he needs to go, rather than what Kadzwane has been trying to do, which in my opinion is trying to grab him by the nose and pull him where she thinks he needs to be, and he will not, and he hasn't, and will continue to not work well or be able to respond well under those conditions. As to what she may or may not bring back from the Finn, I don't know that she'll bring anything back from the Finns, but I think she might have some things, especially like knowledge, like you were talking about, Andrew, that she knew before she went and visited them, that for some reason or another she hadn't been able to give to Rand. And so she's going to be important because of knowledge that she has already gained, especially with the time that she spent in the Great Hunt with Vandine and Aldeus, whatever their names were.
Adelius,
yeah. The time that she had spent with them during the Great Hunt and the things that were taking place around then. And I think that she, especially combined with her trip through Ruhidian and all these other things, she's going to have some really important information that I'm not sure that she got from the Finn that she is going to come back with to help Rand. I mean, she has been on this journey to help the Dragon Reborn since before she became a sister. Saw that in New Spring. And so she's going to have some more than just... during that time, between the time she became a full sister and, you know, the end of New Spring and the time we see her again in Eye of the World, I can't believe that she hasn't learned anything important besides the fact that Rand is the Dragon Reborn. I can believe that she spent most of the time looking for him. I can't believe that he's the only thing that she ever found during that search. And so, whatever it is that she may have, whether or not she got it from the Finn, she's going to have something besides just her calming, soothing, I know how to work with Rand presence.
I've been thinking a lot as to... because the character of Moraine is so etched on most Wheel of Time fans, you know, ideals. You know, she is, partially because she is the first Aes Sedai we've seen in the series, she has a connection to the readers, wherein I think almost all readers judge what an Aes Sedai should be. And I say almost because obviously not everyone thinks the same. But I think, and I know it's true for me, I judge pretty much every Aes Sedai I meet in the series off of Moraine in some way, shape, or form. You know, she was able to manipulate Rand, and it is a manipulation, but she was able to do it subtly, and it wasn't a, I'm not going to bully like Kadzwane has tried, even though I do think that Kadzwane's bullying nature did have an effect and did make Rand react, just not always in the way she wanted him to. The first to stand up and go into essentially a combat sort of thing. She was always sly and very cunning with what she did. She was well-spoken. You know, if a sister I see in the series doesn't meet the qualities, at least some of them, if not most of them, that I see in Moraine throughout the short time that she is with us in the series, I don't really consider her a sister. I look at Elida and go, that's not really a sister. And
well,
it's not really sister because of the fact that she didn't do it right. She didn't do it like Moraine did, and therefore she doesn't deserve to be called Aes Sedai.
Well, yeah, that was set up specifically for that reason. That's why, you know, you think of all the Aes Sedai that we meet in Eye of the World, and there's Moraine and Elida, which are the two extreme opposites of the spectrum that you were just describing there, Andrew. I kind of want to take a little bit of a tangent. You think about the Wheel of Time, the White Tower, and all the Aja. I mean, we meet Moraine, and we learn that she's of the Blue Aja. We don't really know what Aja are. I don't recall if it's in Eye of the World that we find out that Elida is Red Aja. We can obviously tell that she's a little bit different, that she's a little bit different from Moraine. But then we compare this to things like, and this is going to be kind of weird, but we compare it to like Harry Potter, where they have the four houses of Hogwarts. And the way that the book is written, you want each and every one of the characters that you like and love to be in Gryffindor, because Gryffindor is the coolest and best of the houses.
Or at least
whereas,
Ravenclaw.
Yeah. Excuse you? Ravenclaw.
Well, you can't all be in Gryffindor. They have some of them, but that's the only other cool one.
Yeah, well,
I mean, what, you're going to be in Hufflepuff? Give me a break. Come on.
Yeah, I think Ravenclaw is better than Gryffindor, but that's no. Okay, stopping this now. Anyway, but when you look at the Wheel of Time, I kind of expected it to be like that. I expected it to be written where the blue is the best Aja, and you kind of expect everyone to be in the blue. And then we get our Wonder Girls, and none of them.
Green.
Nynaeve and Elaine are in yellow and green, respectively.
Green
I'm
rule.
Egwene would have been green. We get Varin, who's wonderful, who's a brown. The whites, I don't think, have any redeeming persons on them. Even the reds have some redeeming persons, Pravara and others. And grays...
Not so much.
The grays and the whites suck. No.
No.
Don't murder
Green's
me.
Rule.
But
with the grays and the whites, we enter into a gray area.
Anyway... No, but such that no one Aja is actually better in the story than the other. It's not written so that they are. The fact that we believe certain Aja are better than the other simply our own personal preference. There are other fans of the Wheel of Time, Virginia, who would say that the white are better than the green, or that the reds are even better.
Jesse, my friend, my much-missed other female ally here, Jessie, would have definitely agreed with you on that. She was of the white, if she had any choice.
Yeah, but the books are written such that you can such that there are things about each and every Aja that make you not care so much, except for the red. The reds are written to look to be the bad guys for the most part.
Well, apart from the black, yeah.
But that was earlier in the books when we were afraid, oh, the Red Aja are going to get Rand. And it's changed since then, and and RJ introduced characters like Pavara and others to redeem the Red Sisters. And so now it's written so that we don't care what Aja they're in. We care about what they do with that. Whereas you look at things like Harry Potter and others where you have a structure similar where you're sorted into these groups. And you're like, yep, that group's written to be the best. Mm-hmm. If you're not in that group, you're just not as cool. And whenever you're reading the Harry Potter books, if you're not Gryffindor, you're not good. Of course, afterwards, and you start thinking about it, then you realize, no, that's not true. Ravenclaw's the best. But that's beside the point.
No bias there at all. Gee, somebody else actually led us off track more than me. Wow, I'm impressed.
And with a Harry Potter tangent at that.
Yeah, that's the great part is...
No kidding. I always wonder why the Ashaman don't have Ajas. They should. I mean, they really need them. They just have factions. It's not as good.
Yeah, they have the light friends and the dark friends. That's pretty much their Ajas now.
Yeah, pretty much factions, yeah. Okay, well, I thought it was really funny, actually. It was really coincidental that this book cover came out when it did, because I've just been reading New Spring in my annual trip through the Wheel of Time in anticipation of the next book, and I was just reading, I was just getting like a double dose of Moraine, and of course Siwan, and it just really was brought home to me just reading through New Spring, what, as Andrew was saying earlier when he introduced the episode, what a really pivotal character she was right from the get-go. I mean, even as an accepted, you could tell that she was going to matter. You know, there's just something about her that is remarkable. And I mean, even above Siwan, who ended up to be one of the strongest ambulance of all time. So that makes me wonder if, while I can never say Moraine properly, but if that makes you wonder if Moraine isn't going to have an even bigger role when she's rescued from the Ilfin and the Elfin. And I can't wait. Plus, I think that's going to be such an awesome series of scenes because it's going to be so fraught with danger.
Okay, so Moraine, obviously the first time we see her chronologically is in New Spring, although in actual The Order of the Books came out, the first time we see her is kind of this mysterious, aloof woman who is a lady that we don't know too much about in The Two Rivers and Eye of the World. It's interesting, though, when we get into when we're thinking about especially the Eye of the World, the first book, there's a lot of things that Moraine does as an Aes Sedai that you think about them later in the book and you're like, okay, how that doesn't quite make sense or mesh with the rest of the books. And it could simply be because Robert Jordan kind of changed his views on how these things were. Or it could just be that I'm not smart enough to make sense of them. But at first we see Moraine. She's this mysterious woman. When we first meet Moraine, she has the staff that she uses as a foci for her channeling. And we don't see this anywhere else.
No.
We see them using Terangriel and Angriel and things to get more power, to be able to access a greater amount of the One Power, or to use the One Power in specific ways that obviously are too complicated for them or something. But we see her channeling through both the staff and the blue stone that sits in the middle of her forehead. And we don't ever really see anyone else focusing their channeling ability through it. We don't even really see her do it anymore in the rest of the series.
We see her eavesdropping among the Aiel by they're all looking at the blue stone that she holds sparkling, and she's showing them how to listen at a distance like that.
Ooh.
That's her trick, her eavesdropping.
Oh, yeah.
She showed the wise ones.
I'd forgotten that.
Rand kind of looks over and he sees them all kind of staring at this blue stone and wonders what they're doing. Not duh, they're eavesdropping on you, baby.
Yeah, we know. But I'm pretty sure, tell me if I'm wrong, but I don't think we've seen any other channelers do anything similar to that.
The Aes Sedai Daigian, the one that lost her warder, the Ashaman warder, Daigian was a Corianan as well, and she wore a moonstone, Kisira, but it never mentions that she channeled through it. But she could have.
Well, I'm not talking about fashion choices. I'm talking about channeling choices.
Well, but she could have.
So what do you guys think? Why is she the only one that seems to focus her channeling through these different things? Is it just because RJ had a change of mind and decided that to write things differently? Or is it because Moraine is just channels in a... I'm curious to see how she got her staff, because she doesn't have it in New Spring.
No, she never replaces it either. She once it's burned and destroyed after the Trollocs, she never replaces it either.
Yeah, after going through the way gates.
Yeah, I thought that was very odd, since she seemed to use it so much. Why would she never replace it? Can't be that hard to come up with a vine-carved staff. Any of the maidens could have carved one for her. My God, they put dragons on that spear for Rand. I always thought that was odd that she used that so much and then never replaced it when it was destroyed. But I think she just has those things because she's exceptional. I mean, she is, you know, among the top percentage. Even Cat Swain reflects in New Spring that she will be among the highest in strength. You know, once one or two others pass away, she'll be right up there, you know. And it's possible that, well, and now another crazy theory is leaking into my head here. I've had these suspicions about the three girls, the Wonder Girls, as we so sometimes call them. They seem to remember weaves almost as well as being taught them. They discover a lot on their own, but there's specifically one scene with, I believe it's Egwene and Elaine, where one of them hangs a little ball of light on the wall and the other one remembers how to do it, but sees her do it and knows how to do it because she saw her do it, but she was remembering how she did it. I mean, they kind of remember how to do weaves instead of just learn them. And it makes me think that that some of these characters are definitely reincarnations of historical characters that we've been introduced to in the past. I've often thought that Nynaeve might be the reincarnation of the last queen of Menethrin, whose name always escapes me. Was it?
Eldrene.
Yeah, thank you. I could never remember her name. I knew it begins with an E, but I could never think of it. Aemon's wife. And some of the others might, you know, be reincarnations of some of the other strong historical figures, but there isn't enough information to really decide who might be who. Well, we know that Perrin is, probably, because we see that vision, I'm assuming it's in Teleron Riad, but where Balzamon brings him to the room with the striated clouds and the fireplaces with the screaming faces and everything. He sees himself in the mirror like a figure from the past that looks really familiar to him, and I've always thought that that must be some past important figure that he's the rebirth of. And Matt, you know, we know he had the old blood coming out in him from the very beginning. I mean, the first charge after Trollocs, and he's, you know, shouting Karai on Kaldazar, you know, in the old tongue, you know, before even anything ever happened to him other than that he left the Two Rivers. So there's a lot of, you know, history beyond this present life history with these guys, and I'm sort of digressing, but I've often wondered if Moraine isn't, you know, a part of that. And that's why she has some abilities and some, you know, not necessarily talents, but ways of handling the power that nobody else, even in her own Aja, seems to have. That's the other thing I really liked about New Spring, was that they mentioned the each Aja has its own secret tricks, too, secret weaves that they don't reveal to anybody else. I thought that was pretty cool.
I have to wonder.
Some of them were really, really weird, like the entire Blue Aja's ability to control insects. I mean,
I know why.
Who thought of that weave? I mean, like, this was passed down through my Aes Sedai family since the breaking. In the Age of Legends, my Aes Sedai ancestors were pest control.
calling up fleas, and Suwani says, well, if you want to banish fleas from this, then you're going to have to call them first. I thought, oh my goodness, you know, how useless is that?
Yeah.
She brings Dean Ants, you know, to get Lon, and she thinks about wasps, but she's afraid that he's allergic to wasps, but she doesn't, so she doesn't end up doing wasps on him.
I like how she asks him, though, because Master Lon, are you allergic to wasps things? How that finally got a reaction out of him, if not as great a one as she had expected.
Well, the only reason it got a reaction out of him was because he turned to her and got shot with an arrow through his shoulder. It's actually saved his life. He turned in surprise and turned his horse, and that's when the assassins got him and got him through the shoulder with the arrow, and he grunts, and she's really disgusted because he's got an arrow sticking out of him, and all he does is grunt, you know. She's
okay,
like really hoping.
If you've just been punched through the shoulder with the arrow, you might not actually have the ability to do anything but go. I mean, seriously.
Well, yeah, I know, but of course, Lon not only doesn't do anything more than grunt, he doesn't fall from his horse or do anything else. He jumps down off of his horse and goes running after the guys that shot him. Yeah, of course, he's superhuman, apparently. Yeah,
that's wise. Just go running towards the guy with the bow and arrow. Anyway,
well,
that brings up an interesting thing. We read in New Spring about the almost sounds kind of like a courtship period between these two. It just like some weird sadistic way of flirting between them. and yet it just ends up with, you know, she's just going to bond him her warder. That's all. Whatever. No.
Yeah.
That almost seems like a relationship. A more committed relationship than a simple marriage.
Yeah. Well, only Moraine could end up with an uncrowned king for her warder.
Yeah, let me tell. So.
And only Nynaeve can have lined up with that same man as her husband.
I know!
Right!
Talk about love, you know. Well, you know, getting passed around, that poor guy. And Mirelle had him briefly. It's like, Of course, Morel, I think, had him in more ways than one.
Now who's making assertions about the Greens?
Wow.
No, it's not
it
even
was part of
to
the
it.
Healing
it's
process.
Blatant, it's pretty blatantly laid out there that they did, yeah.
Yeah, it was part of the healing process.
Part of the healing process.
I'm going to remember that one, believe me. I wonder how many nurses you saw.
Whenever any warders come up with the whole dead eye said eye thing, you're just gonna. It's part of the healing process.
Trust me, honey. This will help. Okay. Well, yeah.
Well, let's actually talk about the relationship between Moraine and Lon a little bit. The actual warder Aes Sedai relationship, not anything else. I don't think anything else ever.
I don't think they had any other relationship. No.
No, but the I find it strange because, you know, they have the warder training grounds where they train these men to be warders to the Aes Sedai and to behave in a certain way, obviously to be skilled warriors, but also to behave a certain way. Law never got any of that training, and yet he's the best warder that we've ever seen.
Well, again, I think that's because Law is the first warder we ever saw, and therefore all warders get measured against him, much in the same way that all Aes Sedai get measured against Moraine.
Well, not only that, but Robert Jordan has a real penchant for having heroes and heroines who don't need any training to be the best of the best. Look at all three of our girls, and...
For that matter,
I don't need no warder training. I'm already the best. Excuse me? You know, and the girls, they never had any serious Aes Sedai training. Not 10 minutes of it. I mean, they basically got raised to the shawl and scarpered off. And actually, they got raised to accept it and scarpered off. They got raised, Elaine and Nynaeve got raised by Fiat when Egwene became the Amyrlin seat without ever even having been raised to the shawl. I mean, they're all better than everybody without even the least bit of training. I'm sorry, a little accepted training doesn't even count. They weren't even novices.
Well, I'm not sure that the reason they're better than everybody is because I think that might be because they didn't have any of this training. So they don't. Quite honestly, the Aes Sedai training the training that goes on the White Tower is nothing more or less than telling you how you are supposed to think.
Yeah.
There is.
They call it indoctrination.
That's why I think it's such a good. Yeah, that's why I think it's such a good thing that Egwene is now the Amyrlin over the White Tower, because she never got that indoctrination.
Yeah.
She still believes a lot of the same thing as the Ice. Enough. She believes enough of the same things as the majority of the Aes Sedai that she can get away with it, but she never got all this indoctrination, all this crazy crap that they shove into the heads of their sisters.
Yeah.
And so she's going to be much. I mean, this whole idea that you can't experiment with the power, otherwise you're liable to kill yourself, or even worse, burn yourself out. Well, yeah. How many recorded incidents are there? One, two, not
half
very
a dozen.
Many.
Half a dozen.
Not very many that have actually burned themselves out. It's been so impressed on their psyche, you can't experiment with these weeds. You can't experiment with the power, otherwise you'll kill yourself, or even worse. And so ladies who never, these girls who never got that indoctrination, they come along, they're like, hey, I have enough training with the power that I know I'm not going to kill myself, so let's see if I can burn myself out. That's not ever factoring into it. They're like, okay, what can I do with this?
Let's make some drug rail.
And suddenly there's amazing leaps in the knowledge and power of the Aes Sedai as a whole because three girls decided, I'm going to experiment.
Yeah.
Because they hadn't received the indoctrination of, no, you can't do that. No.
Well, and they were all three... superior. They were all three superior and exceedingly talented, which doesn't hurt either.
Well, yeah.
I mean, if they'd been like poor, I'm going to bring her up again, poor Daigian, barely able to qualify for accepted and the shawl by a whisker and a hair, you know, then even if they hadn't been indoctrinated, they might not have been able to come up with anything new. But they're so superior in every way that it's just second nature for them to come up with anything new.
Well,
and the beauty of Egwene is that she's got respect for the traditions of the White Tower without being hidebound, as you say, by the indoctrination.
A lot of the reason that they have this ability, yes, is because they're so powerful, but it's not just because they have the power. It's that because they have the power, there aren't other people above them holding them down. You look at Daigan, and because of the hierarchy of the way power is kind of distributed, or actual political power is distributed amongst the sisters, she's at the bottom, and she can try. She could, if she wanted, I'm sure that she could come up with ways that you can accomplish these big feats with small amounts of power, just because she would have to. Necessity is the mother of invention. But because there are so many people almost brooding down on her, and I don't know, I would guess that that it would feel to her like she's being looked down on, and so she wouldn't have the self-assurance to go out and start experimenting. I'm sure that if someone like in Daigan's situation, only without the oppressiveness of the tower looming over her, they would be able to come up with amazing and wonderful and great things on par with what the Wonder Girls have come up with. The reason the Wonder Girls came up with it is because they're so much stronger than anyone else that the White Tower can't look down on them. That's not in the tradition. That their traditions don't allow for it.
Yeah, about all poor Daigan is allowed to do is serve tea for everybody else. Whereas the first time they tried to run that on Nynaeve and Elaine, they basically said, no. We're in charge, by the way. They did that with the kin. They just started right off the bat and said, I don't think so.
Yeah, and that's a bit in the way they were brought up, too. One of them was brought up as a friggin' princess. The other one is the wisdom of the village. Sorry, Andrew, didn't mean to cut you off.
Oh, that's all right. Don't worry about it. No, I was kind of wondering, since we had gotten on to the subject of the girls, when we do get Moraine back, what do you think the reaction is going to be? Is it going to be something along the lines of, oh, that's information, I will take it in and adapt? Will it be, shock, oh, I didn't expect this much to have happened? Or is it going to be, and I can almost see it, the small secretive smile that, of course, we have missed since Moraine's absence. Just as if, because we know that Min read Egwene a number of times and was able to speak with Moraine about it at least once before everyone got separated and before Moraine's tragic tumble through the doorway. I don't wonder if, coming back and seeing Egwene with a stole on her shoulders isn't something that Moraine might not actually know is going to happen. And, upon coming back, it's more of the kind of relief thing that, oh, look, things are happening the way they have been envisioned or the way that, I have guessed that they would, and therefore I can just continue right along with the plans that I need to continue with.
I think that that's probably what's going to end up happening, because we know that she went through the Ring Tarangriel in Ruhidian and has seen has seen multiple futures. If I'm remembering, that's what the rings do. They show all sorts of possibilities of the future, and so this is going to be something she's expecting to come out, and Egwene's the Amyrlin, and she has the tower. I'm not sure if she will be expecting to hear the history of how that came to be with, she might be expecting that Suan got disposed, whether or not she expects that split the tower in two and all of that hubbub that went on between them. She might react a little bit when she hears about that, but then who knows what may and may not have happened in all those other possible timelines. She could have somehow defeated Lanfear and then stayed there and been instrumental in the healing or breaking of the tower. I don't know.
But doesn't she say that she can only see certain things? Doesn't she say in the letter that she wrote to Tom that she can see the things that she saw in the rings, but not everything? She didn't tell him the rings, but she says, beyond this point, I really can't, say. I can't see beyond a certain point. So she may be in ignorance of a lot of what's happened if she didn't happen to see it in the rings in Meridian. And I have no reason to believe that anything that she saw in the rings was... I would think that the only things that she saw in the rings were things that directly pertained to her, not just general world events. She may not know that Egwene is the Amyrlin Seat. She may not know that Sawan was deposed. It doesn't touch her future directly. It might not be. And the other thing that just sort of occurred to me when we were talking a minute ago was that we're all anxious to see Moraine come back. Everybody wants her back. But what if the characters in the book don't greet her with such overwhelming enthusiasm? What if Cadswain seems to think that she's, you know, upsetting her private little apple cart? What if Egwene isn't all that thrilled to have her previous mentor, if you will, popping back in again? I mean, there are a lot of possibilities to that I haven't really even thought about before. I just assumed everybody's going to greet her with joy and celebration. But you know what? Even Rand may be really glad to have her come back because he won't have the guilt. But he may not want to let her anywhere near him to tie more strings on him again. You know, they didn't leave under the most felicitous of circumstances. They were still knocking heads quite a bit, although they had reached a bit of an agreement on how to, that he would allow her to teach him and she would, you know, basically kowtow to him in order to get that done.
Well, I don't know. I think personally, and this just might be wishful thinking, I want things to end up, but I think that all of those who left the Two Rivers and Eye of the World are going to greet her with varying states of relief and gratitude that she's back, including Nynaeve. I think even Nynaeve is going to have matured enough and grown enough to be able to forgive her and welcome her back.
Especially since she got the guy in the end.
Yeah. I cannot wait to see the epic showdown and battle of wills will be Moraine and Cadswane going at it. And it'll be all polite over tea with smiles, but it's going to be epic. Egwene, I think, is going to be glad to have her back. It's going to be glad that she is safe. I'm not sure if she'll even see her, because we can pretty much assume that once Moraine gets out of the tower and gets kind of talks with Matt, and gets Matt back with his kids, that his band, that one of the first things she's going to do is find Rand. And she might actually, because the band will be left in Camelot, she might actually have to find Elaine for that. I don't know. But one of the first things she's going to do is find Rand, so I'm not sure when Egwene is going to find out. But I think when she does, she's going to be glad that Moraine is safe, in so much that, one, Moraine was a significant mentor to her, and two, Moraine is a sister of the tower. And Egwene will still understand that Moraine is a sister of the tower, and I, as the Amyrlin, am her leader. And I think she'll be happy that Moraine, her mentor, is back, and Moraine, one of her sisters, is back, but she's still going to behave as an Amyrlin should. Rand, though, I don't know, because in the Gathering Storm, Rand thinks that, you know, everything started going wrong after Moraine died, and so I'm not sure just what he'll think. Obviously, I think, like you say, one of the first things is going to be the relief of that burden of guilt that he's had for books and books and these however many months have transpired between then and now. And it might only be weeks, but I'm pretty sure it's been months. Beyond that, I don't know. I think initially he'll be very glad to have her back, and I'm not sure if it'll change from there. As much as I want to see this epic showdown between Moraine and Cadswain, it's going to be an even more epic showdown between Randall Thor, the Dragon Reborn, versus Moraine and Cadswain.
The Aes Sedai Reborn.
I was kind of going through some of the worst possible ideas for reactions of people at seeing Moraine back. Of course, there's Moraine runs into Nynaeve. There was something to the effect of, Nynaeve, it's good to see that you're well. I'm glad you're alive, but I still don't plan on being Aes Sedai, even though I am one. I will get you for this, and your little dog, too.
And I know Balefire now, honey.
and then the probably penultimate terrible way or reaction that could happen, and we're going to pray doesn't. Rand, I didn't actually die. I have come back to help you. Oh, I know what happened. The Dark One brought you back from the grave. Die, Dark Friend. Balefire.
And I can feel guilty twice. Twice as much. Oh,
I know they will not happen, but
I hope
number
not.
One, I do expect there to be a little bit of conflict between Nynaeve and Moraine. I really hope that, unlike her lapse in the most recent book, that Nynaeve regains some of the maturity that she gained throughout the series and is somewhat a bigger woman than she very well could be, because rereading through Eye of the World with my wife recently, I've gotten to see that entire I will learn to use power, and if anything happens to any of the people in Steel, then that I'll use it against you. And I'm sitting there thinking, oh God, look how much just happened to the people from Emmons Field at the very beginning. It's like, if she holds Moraine responsible for all of that still, then someone severely needs to, like, smack Nynaeve upside the head.
Yeah. Okay, here's a question. Do you think that Suan Sanche will be able to hold her Aes Sedai composure when she sees her childhood friend return from the grave?
Oh, no. That's a total, it's not happening. If they come into contact with each other, I think it'll be hilarious because Moraine won't know who Suan is, because Suan looks so much different now than she did.
And her power level's way off, too.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
Why is this weird woman coming up to me?
Why is she staring at me?
Why is this strange lady bawling at my feet?
Why?
Chick flick crying moment, yep.
Why is she trying to become my pillow friend again? I really thought that was not likely, and I came out on the other side of that thing, but after reading New Spring again, I'm beginning to wonder.
Well, in New Spring, they actually kind of make it explicit. Hetswane really does just come straight out and say,
yeah.
And Moraine thinks to herself, she had no right to be or to get into such personal business.
Yeah, exactly. She didn't deny it.
And it was just
she didn't deny it. She wasn't outraged because she thought that of her. She was outraged because of her Kyrian and modesty, and it was revealed to others. So I guess I have to retract what I had said in defense of Moraine previously. As far as that little relationship, I guess it was somewhat more than I had envisioned at first.
Again, we've been trying to decide how various people are going to react. And yes, I do kind of agree on the Egwene situation. I think Egwene the person will be very overjoyed, and Egwene the Merlin is going to have to be more sober about it. Happy, obviously, as you said, Spencer, that, you know, we've got a sister that we thought was lost, and, you know, this was a person who, you know, helped me to become who I am, but at the same time, you know, recognizing that, yes, I being Merlin, still in control of this. This is another person whom is working for the goals that I am now the spearhead for. So I do kind of agree with that. Min is probably going to totally fall apart. Well, she didn't, you know, well, she's confused over this, you know, how can Rand possibly, you know, succeed without a woman who's dead and gone, and suddenly she's back, and it's like, I totally didn't see that coming.
But on the other hand, I wasn't wrong the first time.
Yeah, it'll probably take a little bit of a weight off of her mind.
Not really, though. Because she's kind of been clinging to that frail hope that maybe my viewings are wrong and Rand isn't going to die based on the fact that she was wrong about Moraine. And when she meets Moraine and realizes, I wasn't wrong. My viewings aren't wrong. Rand's going to die.
Yeah.
I think men will have a little bit of an episode.
Bad news, you know? Yeah, it's good news and bad news. I was right, but bad news is, my lover's going to die. The bad news is I was right, too. Yeah, it's not going to be necessarily a really good day for men.
It'll be one of those kind of mind-blowing experiences for her. Perrin, I don't see Perrin running into Moraine prior to the last battle at all, if he does even then. I envision Perrin being off and about on his, in his own kind of journey, and he kind of actually was, even after Moraine and Lon and Nynaeve rescued Egwene and Perrin from the White Cloak camp in Eye of the World. Perrin has been a withdrawn and distant character. And the connection between him and Moraine kind of snapped earlier than anyone else in the series. So I envision him not even being present to have a reaction. I will be interested to see what, if any, reaction Moraine has to Varen being dead.
Yeah.
Because in some ways, we know that Moraine and Varen had a history as well, including the... And it seems interesting. You ever notice a lot of the surprise black Aja are some of the nicest people you meet in the series? Oh, I remember two accepted who got switched and who I, sneaked honey cakes, from the kitchen for and stuff like that. It's just like, really? Marine was so nice and understanding, and I cried on her shoulder so many times. Really? It's just like, there's a nice Aes Sedai. She must be a black.
It's those normal ones that are going to be the light for it. No.
I don't know. I got
going back to talking about Perrin. Yeah. Going back to talk about Perrin a little bit, if we do get a chance to see his reaction, I don't think it'll be that extreme. It'll be like, Moraine, hey, well, that's cool.
Hey, how you doing?
Because he wasn't there when she died. And honestly, of the relationships that were forged during Eye of the World, not the ones that were in place before the events of Eye of the World, but the ones that were forged during Eye of the World, the relationship between Perrin and Moraine or Tom or any of the other interlopers, any other Two Rivers people of that group, he didn't really forge those stronger connections. The greatest relationship that Perrin gained in the Eye of the World was with Elias. And so even when Perrin does see that Moraine's alive, he'll just be like, oh, look, cool, she's not dead anymore. Okay.
Well, what do you think Tom's reaction is going to be when he finally rescues her? Are they going to fall into each other's arms and cover each other with kisses, or are they going to be just pick up their relationship where it left off, formal but a little flirtatious?
They're going to be more in love with each other. The whole absence makes the heart grow fonder thing, and we've seen that from Tom.
He certainly besotted, yeah.
In Knife of Dreams. But still, I think because of their relative ages, his mature age and maturity and her Aes Sedai and maturity, I guess, is an interesting way of putting it. But I think that they'll be able to not do the whole kind of grossly romantic covering each other with kisses and staring into each other's eyes. And there's so many things that are said without words, but I think that even though their relationship has progressed beyond where it was, they'll still kind of hold their composure a bit more. I don't know. They might not wait too long to get married after he gets her out of that blasted tower.
Well, I hear you're in the market for another order.
Yeah, that. I'm not sure if he could ever give up the Gleeman's cloak for fan cloth, though.
Are you kidding? Fan cloth is like the ultimate Gleeman's cloak, except it works in reverse. It's still flashy and still kind of draws the eye, unless you're like in a camouflaging type setting.
I will tell you grand stories.
Oh God, please put the cloak away. It's making me sick.
Yeah. I don't know though, because he's spent a lot of time on that cloak to make it what it is today. And just to kind of hang it up in favor of the... I mean, he might wear the fan cloth as like an outer rain cloak or something. I don't know. Or just keep it, you know, like those scarves that the clowns all have tucked up their sleeves. He pulls it out for some flashy tricks or something. I don't know. I'm sure if anyone... I'm sure that if anyone could figure out a way to use it in a showman... to use fan cloth in a showmanship style, it'll be Tom.
Tom and the first ever set of Heron Mark daggers.
And, you know, he'll be the first quote-unquote magician, you know, performing optical illusions rather than actual magic to please the crowds. And so the people won't be going there thinking, oh, that is so cool. That is so cool. Well, I mean, what you can do with magic is so... they'll be going there thinking, okay, so how did he do that? Of course, then, you know, he'll get caught by the Reds and they'll try and gentle him, and that just won't work.
So do you think Matt's going to be smarmy about rescuing Moraine?
I think that after they get out of the tower, the traveling conditions between with him, Tom, and Moraine there, with or without Oliver or Noel or this mysterious third person, I think he'll kind of go back mentally to the state they were in when they left the Two Rivers, and he'll kind of act like that a little bit, but when push comes to shove, he'll still be what he'll still do what he needs to do better than anyone else can do it. So he might act slightly immature and smarmy, as you put it, and then they're set upon by Trollocs and he kills them all without batting an eyelash.
Just really wanted an excuse to use the word smarmy, but at the same time, I was kind of wondering, because it's... you know, how many times did we get reminded, you know, hey, Nynaeve, Elaine, and Egwene, I pulled your bacon from the fire, you know, back to the Stone of Tyr. And, you know, I really don't want the last book having multiple references to, hey, Moraine, I pulled your bacon out of the fire back in the world of the Finns. Getting you back cost me cost me an eye.
You owe me.
Oh, no. Unlike...
that's to my depth perception.
Yeah.
Yeah, really?
Unlike the Wonder Girl, she'll actually repay the debt rather quickly, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, Meth's depth perception is going to be really, really shot when he loses an eye. He's not going to be able to throw his dagger at pieces of wood thrown in the air blindfolded, you know?
Who knows? Maybe his luck will compensate.
Yeah, maybe.
I just had a thought, and this could just be because of the artist again, but... why doesn't Matt have his fox head medallion on in this picture?
Why doesn't he have his hat on?
Why is his coat not long and green? It's green, but it's not long.
And where is his scarf?
Yeah.
The black scarf.
Central.
Yeah. Well, going back to when Jason was talking about all these things that he does for Wheel of Time during the day,
tweet about us.
He provides feedback about upcoming Wheel of Time ebook covers, just continuity things. Why don't they have him do that for the rest of them, please?
Yeah, I know.
Have someone check continuity, please.
Well, it was like Knife of Dreams with the gigantic eel man in the background.
Three times the size of every other person on the cover.
I know. At least there are no, you know, dwarf horses on this cover. That's always my pet peeve. The Darryl Sweet horses definitely not belong to this universe.
All right, back on Moraine. The interesting thing, she is a Damodred. She's the daughter of Dalrysian Damodred. I don't know. And she's actually half-sister of Terengal Damodred, so through convoluted ways, she's as related to Rand as Elaine is. Well, maybe a little less so. But anyway.
Well, she's more related to Elaine than she is to Rand.
Yeah. Well, yeah, she actually is related to Elaine through blood. She isn't to Rand, but neither is Elaine, although Rand is related to Galad, who is related to Elaine. But Rand isn't related to Elaine. Don't ever try and trace that family tree.
It gives me a headache to talk about.
Orc. Anyway, Moraine, being a Damodred, because of her lineage, she actually could be considered in line to take the Sun Throne. Being as it is currently vacant, who do you think has a better shot of getting the Sun Throne, Moraine or Elaine?
Well, I've often said that I thought that Moraine, who did not want it when she was first raised to Aes Sedai and Rahman was first killed, now has, you know, 20-some years of hustling all around the world and a lot of experiences and so forth and so on, she may feel quite differently about assuming the Sun Throne now than she did, you know, when Tamra Ospenya was Ommerlin. And we commented on this in a previous podcast. If she and Tom then were married and Moraine ascended the Sun Throne, that would make Tom, well, if not king, at least certainly prince consort of Carrion, which I think would be deliciously ironic since he's probably the one who killed Galdrian. Arranging, the hunting accidents and all these things.
Yeah, I don't know.
Probably.
Well, he arranged
a little bit more than probable.
It's very strongly implied that he killed Galdrian because he had his girlfriend at the time, Diana, or whatever her name was, killed. It's also very strongly implied that he arranged Terengale's hunting accident because he had rumors of a plot that he wanted to supplant Morghaz and become first king of Andor. The ubiquitous hunting accidents, I love it. Andrew, I know you feel the same way as I do about that fabulous medieval excuse for somebody conveniently disappearing and dying.
Yeah, the hunting accident, kind of like in George R. R. Martin's Song of Ice and Fire, how anyone ever under the care of the Maesters is automatically doomed to die. the class of healers in that world uniformly don't save anyone's life. They all always kill the person under their care. It's hilarious. It's like, oh,
well, these
he's
days,
being treated by
these
the
days
Maesters,
not...
so that means he's dead.
These days it's not a hunting accident, though. These days it's a tragic boating accident, a la Natalie Wood.
Boating or you know, small aircraft are so unreliable. I would think that Moraine might do better with the Sun Throne. I still think she probably doesn't want it. I think being blue to the core, she has to see Rand all the way through. And as much as I love Moraine, she actually goes on my list of persons who it's questionable if they survive the last battle.
Oh, not after all that.
As much as I hate to say it, because yes, I agree entirely with the sentiment you're just about to express, Virginia, to have her gone for so long a time, to get her back just to lose her again, would be terribly tragic, but I could also see it being right in line with Moraine. We know now that she definitely would sacrifice herself in order to see the dragon succeed. And, you know, just
I could see it being one of those things. I sincerely hope I am wrong and that she does continue onward. But, you know, I look at the major characters, and there are so many of them that I don't want to die. And I know that some of them have to, because, you know, just the, hey, everybody's all right at the end of the last battle can't happen. It, you know, it's too fairy tale-ish. And even some of the fairy tales that I'm acquainted with, you know, not a lot of the main characters survive.
I don't know. She's already been lost to us once. She's already sacrificed herself around once. I just don't see that happening again, so I think it would be almost derivative at this point.
We know that Moraine would be willing, I think even after she gets out of the tower again, I think she would be willing to sacrifice herself again for Rand. I don't think that RJ or Brandon would allow it to happen, because at this point I think it would just be like a cheap trick. I mean, yeah, she sacrificed herself once, and that was a great thing, you know? From a storytelling standpoint, that was an absolutely wonderful scene, wonderful plot, the way that worked out. To have it happen again, though, I think would just be a little bit too much.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not sure if I'm expressing myself well, but...
No, I get exactly what you're saying, and, yeah, like I said, if I have to rate the likelihood of us losing her again, I would have to rate it fairly low. It's just one of those weird things that, you know, as I try to pick through who's going to bite it in the last battle, you know, it's like, wow, I'm surprised to actually find myself putting her name on the list. Particularly because, yes, like I said, we have seen it before. And, you know, it's one of those weird... You know, in a way, then she almost becomes like one of the Forsaken, you know, if we can't get rid of her. Which is not that we would want to, but at the same time, oh, you know, there are certain tropes that I just want to say that they are possible, and I certainly hope we don't see them, because frankly... Yeah, but there's only so many times you can dip into the bucket.
Yeah. And you know, it's kind of corny to think about, or kind of odd to think about, but Moraine really is following the mentor niche pretty well when you think about fantasy literature. You think of the and other great fantasy... Lord of the Rings, Gandalf. He's there for a while, and he sacrifices himself to save the heroes.
Why, you fool?
Obi-Wan Kenobi. He's there, he starts teaching, and then he dies. Moraine, she's there, she starts teaching, she starts leading, and then she disappears. And for each and every one of them, they are coming back. But after that, they don't leave again. And so I think... As much as this isn't following the common paths through the fantasy forest, there are certain ones that it has stuck to, and I don't see Moraine coming back just to leave again.
Well, one of the reasons to do that is to get a really powerful character out of the way in order for the other soon-to-be powerful characters to get a chance to grow and, you know, shine a little bit against all the odds. And then the other reason is to keep a really powerful character from being too powerful. And I think there was a little of both going on with Moraine. Had to get her out of the way for a while. She was just too competent.
Yeah, especially when you look at both her ability not only to take on a full couple of banners of Trollocs, complete with their mind draw, charge headlong into the Blight, take on
Kill
the Forsaken. And not only all that, but also her political savvy, manipulate the freaking White Tower around her finger. Well, hers and Suan's fingers, because they were bound together in a pinky promise or something, I don't know. The metaphor kind of stops there. But and then also to be able to manipulate Rand the way she did, and to manipulate, for heaven's sake, she got the Aes Sedai the Aes Sedai. Oh, for heaven's sake, she got the Aiel wise ones to let her go into Rohirrim. What?
Yeah.
The political the ability she has to get people to do what she wants them to do is astronomical. Is amazing. And then she dies.
And she's not even Tavirin.
Yeah, it's great.
Oh, that we know of.
Ooh, do we consider her a major character?
Oh, she's been out of the books for so long, maybe not. She doesn't need to be. She's got everything going for her anyway.
Yeah, I don't know.
She doesn't need to be more powerful. She doesn't need to be Tavirin.
She's hot, she's powerful, but she's short.
Well, that's the only flaw that I can see.
Well, and she's Carhean.
Oh, depends on your worldview. Some people don't mind them. Olan didn't like them, but he managed to swallow his dislike of Carhean and let himself be bonded by one. Remember in New Spring, he thinks that there are only two things that are really... she's a combination of two of the worst things, an Aes Sedai and a Carhean. Could it be any worse?
Yes.
Well,
her name's Cat Swain.
It's already been mentioned today in this particular podcast that, you know, she convinced the Aiel wise ones to let her into Rohirrim, and she's a Carhean. Wait a minute, didn't your uncle cut down our tree?
Wait, you
Moraine tree killer.
You let the Oathbreakers into the Rohirrim. Whoa! Faint away.
All right, cool it in. Calm down.
Oh, yeah.
No.
I'll have you know these tattoos are perfectly authentic.
Actually, they were. Asmodian put them on. They were the real deal.
All right, so all you need was flows of water and sugar.
I will be ever saddened that we didn't actually get to see the battle between Matt and Cooladin.
I know. He just sort of glosses over that, doesn't he?
Well, he glosses over a lot of the battles. I mean, you think about all this, all of the battles that we've seen. How much does he actually describe the fighting? I mean, he talks about the general standing back shouting orders, or he skips to the aftermath.
I am not a hero.
Or he gets to ranges
in a box.
Oh, I'm
no bloody hero. Yeah, I'm no bloody hero. But he is.
It seems like in the larger battles, it's harder to describe, you know, specific things that are happening, because... I mean, a lot of it usually condenses down into one character doing something. Like, you know, when we're following Perrin through the battle to the Gates of Mauldin, even though, yes, it culminates in a truncated battle and then quick, you know, arrowed to death of Aram. But, you know, you get scenes like that. You know, we see Rand stalking through the hallways of the Stone of Tyr, while we know battles are going on around him, and there's a little action here, but there's not a whole lot that we need. We see the battle starting, you know, with Matt taking an arrow, you know, at the beginning of the battle in Knife of Dreams, and, you know, we see the first dragon eggs being flung by slings and stuff, and you don't see the whole battle, but you see little snippets of it here and there, and you know, on that, on the grand scale of, look, there are hundreds of men on the battlefield. It's so difficult to describe the general chaos of that sort of combat that, you know, I think it's necessary that it gets pulled down into the smaller settings. And in some cases, it is just easier to go, you know, you see the character, it's afterwards. You know, he can remember back to specific instances where his life was very nearly in danger. You know, I can remember that Cooladin's spear was, you know, amazingly fast and, you know, having to dance out of the way and taking several wounds. And, you know, it might have just been luck at the end. And, you know, those kinds of thoughts just make it a little easier narratively to illustrate, which is an odd combination of words.
Not really. I mean, that's what the writers attempt to do, is to illustrate, to create pictures and images in your mind, which is illustration, only verbally rather than with some other colorful medium.
Or maybe art is just a little bit like Varin and tends to kind of skip over the battles and move to the important part.
Yes, the two pages describing the shrubbery around the Wine Spring Inn.
A little Michener-esque moment there. I'll never forget four pages discussing a rock. Well, it seemed like four pages anyway. And not even a very special rock. Just
okay, so we talked about what we think Moraine might and others around her might do after she gets out of the Tower of Genji. But what do you think she's doing now while she's actually being... I'm not sure if she's being held there or if she just can't get out of the Tower of Genji.
Well,
I don't know, but it seems like it'd be pretty boring. I hope there's some... I hope they at least have cable, huh?
Live tonight on the... No, I don't even know. On that Iovision.
They can fold time and see the past and the future. They ought to be able to provide some kind of entertainment.
You know, when you think about it, time is different there. They've already established that. So we don't really know for her how long it seems like she's been there. Another part of that is she at least implies in her letter to Tom that coming to get her is dangerous and potentially fatal for everyone involved, including herself.
Yeah.
So I kind of have to imagine that bad things are happening to her. You know, if it were just kind of sitting around in, you know, the, you know, Shia Ghoulish version of a waiting room with bad elevator music. You know, I think, you know, that would be, you know, there wouldn't be a need to go, well, all of you could die, and myself included, in the attempt if you come to get me, or not. You know,
well,
it seems like, you know, well, make sure you sign in and ring the bell twice so that the person comes up to the front desk and they can check me out. I mean, it seems like there's going to have to be definitely some real trick using the various things from the poem of the snakes and the foxes to get her free in the first place, let alone everybody or as many people who are getting out actually getting out.
Well, they may be holding her and not necessarily doing anything bad to her, but that doesn't mean that they're necessarily going to let her go willingly, you know. I mean, they may be holding her from reasons of their own, but it may not have anything to do with an unpleasant experience on her part. But they might highly object to her being removed, and that would be the danger part for all of them. And there's a lot of uncertainty there, too. You know, she said in the letter that she saw, you know, one being killed, all being killed, some, you know, et cetera, various permutations of it, one set in stone. It all depended on who he brought with him and what they did when they got there. She saw many variations.
I wonder, you know, what value the Finns are getting from her that is worth the amount of trouble it's going to be. I mean, we know, presumably, the cost to Matt of getting her out, or at least part of the cost for Matt. You know, I and some others assume that if Noel is the one to go in, that, you know, poor Jane isn't coming back out, you know, kind of alleviating a earlier debt to, you know, various people. So he kind of mentions, when speaking about himself in the third person, about how, you know, Jane was a fool and, you know, kind of like, you know, he left a wife and blah, blah, blah. You know, kind of basically gave him that, you know, that he has past sins to atone for and, you know, it's going to end up with him probably not being one of the ones who makes it back out. Which, of course, you know, for me, then sets up that Ulver comes in and takes up the third-person position. If it's not, you know, mysterious guy from the cover. And then, you know, that's kind of that sort of setting where, you know, what kind of value is she to the Finns that all of this is set up and necessary?
Well, maybe they need Aes Sedai to study. You know, you have postulated in the past that the Finn might have been the ones to originally teach humankind to use the One Power, but, you know, maybe they don't know all there is to know about it. Maybe they need to have, you know, actual power wielders visit them periodically in order for them to, you know, progress. I mean, why would they, you know, stand still with no change when nothing else does?
That's true.
I don't know. Just a thought.
No, what really, I think the reason why they had to keep Moraine there is, if we go back to earlier when Matt had gone and visited them, he noticed that there were layers of dirt on the floor and such, and so they needed someone to come and clean up all this dirt that they just had accumulating everywhere because, you know, there was no traffic, so...
She's a noble. She's not going to be cleaning anything.
Uh-huh, right.
We have staff for that.
But they don't, apparently, because there's no one else there to clean. No.
Well,
in all seriousness, though...
That's a Finn's problem, not hers.
In all seriousness, though, this isn't the first time that... when she fell through the doorway in Cardian, it wasn't the first time that she had actually gone to this alternate universe or wherever the heck it is that the Finn exist. She also went in the Shadow Rising. Through the doorway in the Stone of Tyr. And, you know, it's kind of interesting because we never find out what she asked the Elfin, so we don't know what their answers were.
No, but it wasn't long after that she gave one of the girls that little cryptic response about how she would wager that she knew the face of the man she would marry better than they did.
Yeah.
So one wonders if one of her questions didn't reveal Tom for the first time.
I kind of have to doubt it, just because with the way things were at that point in the story, she would have been much more focused on Rand and the last battle than on, oh, who am I going to marry?
Well, I don't think she was focused on who she was going to marry, but if she asked a question about the course of her future, that certainly might have come up. Asked a question that touched on something else, and the answer could have been something couched in riddles, saying that, no, you won't have that, but you'll have this, you know.
Yeah. Well, and also,
I mean, something on the order of, I'm envisioning something on the order of Tuan's prophecy from the Damani Lydia, you know, beware of the man who does this and that, for he will set you free, beware of that man, for he will marry you, sort of, you know, gobbledygook. That's what they would probably give her, but I'm sure that she's just as good as interpreting that stuff as anyone, maybe better.
So another question is, when Moraine goes with Rand to Ruhidian, she knows that the Wise Ones are going to let her go down, are going to send her into the city, or that she's going to go into the city at all. But I don't remember, is that actually in the letter that the Wise Ones sent to her? Or is this something that she might have picked up in the Tower of Genji, that she had to go to Rohidian, similar to what Matt got?
Well, if she didn't pick it up in the Tower of Genji, she might have picked it up in the Stone of Tyr, that she needed to go to... Meridian.
What's
I don't know.
Fin?
I would
Whatever.
Assume so. I would assume that she might have had part of that as an answer. I mean, Rand, after all, got... it was Matt got that as part of his answer. You must go to Meridian. He got that as part of his second set of answers that he didn't really deserve. You must go to Meridian.
He came out and he said,
well, maybe they tell everybody they need to go to Meridian. And he said, they didn't tell me that, Matt. He just decided to go on his own, remember? Rand did.
Yes. No, actually, Matt's question was...
I got it wrong?
If he should go home and help his people, and they say, you must go to Ruhidian, and all of a sudden he freaks out. It's like, what? Why?
Oh, right. You're right.
And then he gets the... He wastes his next two
questions with, why should I? If you do not go to Ruhidian, you must die. He asked why he will die. You will have sidestepped the threat of fate, blah, 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 blah. And then he starts yelling at them again, and then they yell back at him.
and then he gets
his three extra answers.
And then they 86 him, well and truly.
Then they throw his butt out!
Yep. They're bringing the bouncers, you're gone. He's Taverin. They're too much. Very demanding.
Yeah. But going even further off topic, though, why would the two Taverin be too much on the because I'm not sure if it's on their collective psyche or if it's on the world. Why is there this, this strain on them when they have the Taverin near them?
Well, remember, the entire place was also tolling like a bell at the same
time.
I honestly think that the Taverin twisting of the pattern has an effect on the almost the physical pattern of the Finn's world.
Yes, but why? And if I might put forward my own crazy theory, I don't recall if I've talked about this in previous podcasts or not, but it almost seems to me, based on this, that the world that the Finn inhabit is separate from the world that the pattern exists in. Not just that world that our main characters live on, but the world that the pattern exists in. Because we know that there can be things outside the pattern. We have vacuoles and such that we've seen the Forsaken be trapped in. And so I have to wonder, and why I assume this is because, you know, the only way I can see that the two Taverin would have that profound an effect is if, because they twist the pattern around them, them leaving the pattern and going to whatever other world this is starts to pull that world into the pattern too, and that causes a strain on them. But in any case, what effect do you think this will have when Matt has to re-enter the world of the Finn to save Moraine?
Well, I don't know. I think we're going to get that same sort of effect from one Taverin that we had from two.
I don't think we'll get the same effect from just the one, but there still will be an effect. And so I have to wonder what that will do. And perhaps that's the way they'll cheat. They'll cheat by having a Taverin in the game.
Well, obviously, that's a cheat right off the bat, yeah.
Well, I'd also be kind of interested. They obviously have to, you know, find a way around the various, you know, ancient accord rules and whatnot. And I'm now thinking back, it's like, dragon's eggs, you say? Not constructive iron, you say? Capable of producing light at a moment's notice with just the barest of sparks, you say?
Well, I rather thought that's what the fireworks were all about, rather than the dragon's eggs, but
the dragon's eggs, they're compacted and more shrapnel-y.
You ruined the side of the Stone of the Tear with some of his fireworks.
Yeah, it's great. I don't know, I've always kind of assumed that Matt was just going to kind of go in and break all the rules. No iron? Too bad! No music. La.
No music. La 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 la.
La 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 la. Talk to the
hand. He's bringing Tom with him. Tom is not going to leave his instruments and music behind, no matter what the situation is.
And the Finn are going to sit there going la 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 la, not listening. Not watching.
That never ends. If it turns on and on, my friend.
Oh no! Make it stop!
The creator started turning it, not knowing what it was.
Well, what part do you think Moraine will play?
Because it is the wheel that never...
I think that Moraine is going to pick up the soprano part.
No. What part do you think Moraine will play in her rescue? You think she's just going to be a passive damsel in distress? I don't think so.
Maybe the harp? I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Can she channel in there at all?
We don't know.
Well, we know channeling is possible in there.
We do?
We do?
Yes, because remember, Rand backs out of the door frame.
Oh, that's right.
Rand here wielding the sword of fire.
That's right.
Oh, yeah.
Good catch. Andrew gets the Cat of the Day Award.
and if the Finns are responsible for human channeling, then obviously they have to be able to channel there as well to some extent.
Well, that's on the order of a crazy theory. We've batted that around, but we don't know that they are.
That's why I said if it turns out that it's
back. Yeah. And who gets the Catch of the Day Award?
Well, you know, I'm sure that there's a lot more that we could talk about, but I think we're going to want to wrap it up for tonight. Yeah, that's been our discussion on Moraine Damodred. It's just one amazing Aes Sedai, like Andrew said, kind of cornerstone of the stories, the measuring stick against all other Aes Sedai are measured against, even though she's only about 5 foot.
Except for Viren, who stands apart and on her own, towering like a titan. Miss Viren. Can Viren come back? If a Moraine's coming back, can Viren come back, please? Can she? Come on, Brandon, bring her back.
Well, the problem there is the only person that's ever brought, the only being that's ever brought people back from the dead has been the great Lord of the Dark, and I'm not sure that he does that for traitors like Asmodean and Varen.
I don't think so, but hey, can't the Creator make an exception for just once? I mean, it's Varen, for Light's sake. Varen Balin,
I think he's going to have to make an exception for Rand. I'm not sure he'll have it in the he'll have an extra get out of death free card for Varen.
Oh, well, I can dream, I suppose.
Yeah.
Although there are two in every game, so maybe.
Yeah. At least we're getting Moraine back. Yay! We're going to the tower again. It's about time.
So what the heck are we going to be doing with the Towers of Midnight?
I'm not going to Seanchan. You could go to Seanchan.
The freaking Seanchan Prince of the Ravens is going to the Tower of Genji. Who's going to the Towers of Midnight? The Empress? May she live forever? Possibly, but why?
Maybe Matt will be transported from the Tower of Genji immediately to the Towers of Midnight by some magical mystery, elfin trickery.
And then they'll have to teach Moraine how to travel really quickly so that they can get out before she gets leashed.
No kidding. Yeah, Moraine's got a few tricks to catch up on. Traveling, who'd have thunk it? Egwene came up with that? Wow, I taught her really well. Unlike Kent Swain, whose favorite line is probably, well, I taught her everything she knows, but I didn't teach her everything I know.
As I said, we could probably go on quite a bit, but this is where we will leave off for this particular podcast. If you have any thoughts, ideas, questions, comments, criticisms, if you like the things we said, if you don't like the things we've said, you know, anything at all, we love hearing from the listeners, and there are a number of different ways you can get a hold of us. You can, of course, give us a call and leave us a voicemail at dragonmount.com at 1-888-333-7690.
And you can also reach us by email at podcast@dragonmount.com. Another way is to look on dragonmount.com for the podcast pages and leave comments there. Most of us cruise through the pages periodically, and we'll leave comments as well. And occasionally we get some nice spirited discussions going on.
Also on dragonmount.com, in their forum section, there is a forum for the Fourth Age. And this really isn't used as much as the comment section on the podcast page. We want you to know that it is there, and we do check it often. Also, the dragonmount.com and the Fourth Age have accounts on several of the social networking sites. Most prominent, of course, are the Twitter feeds that we have. Dragonmount is, well, Dragonmount. Fourth Age is that with no spaces. It's 4-T-H-A-G-E. And you can also look for the Dragon Mount and the Fourth Age podcast groups on Facebook.
Yep, and we'll be glad to friend you. If you just send us a message with podcast in it somewhere, we'll know that's where you know us, and we'll be friends.
Also, if you have it available to you, a number of the long-range communication, Terangriel, or we have one or two that we are allowed access to. If you can get access to one of them, we would love to receive, and we will respond to your inquiries via those.
Yeah, they don't let us use them often, though. Okay. It's kind of rude, really.
You can also, of course, open a 1-inch by 8-inch gateway and shove a letter through to us.
Send more Kleenex.
Please make sure, though, if you're going to use a gateway, that it is at least 10 feet in the air. That way you do not run the risk of accidentally gutting one of our relatives or pets.
Well, or you can activate the gateway chime if you know how to do that weave. That always works.
And we will vacate the area for you. Also,
yes, just send a voicemail or an email. It's ever so much easier.
Yes,
especially plus, if you send a voicemail, you will almost certainly be included in one of our shows, unless you say nasty things and swear words that we can't. The FCC won't allow us, even in these benighted times.
Yes, unfortunately, we do not have a censor on payroll. So if we get one that if we get a voicemail that has to be censored, we'll just drop it entirely.
That's right. Actually, we're also experimenting with a number of different ways of recording the show, and there is a possibility that we could try a live streaming show, and if that is the case, we may open it up to live callers. So if any of you are interested in doing that, let us know if you think it's worth the time and the trouble. It would be we generally record in the evenings on weeknights, so it may not be the most convenient thing in the world for live call-ins, but, you know, it could happen. Let us know what you think. We always want to know what you think.
Well, I want to thank Virginia and Andrew for letting me join you tonight. I also want to thank every one of our volunteer editors for all the work that they do. They do an amazing job on all of these. We have been able to crank out so much completed material thanks to all of you, and so we're actually ahead a bit, and we're thinking, okay, well, we got some good material tonight. Maybe we should rearrange the posting lineup.
Well, I second that. Thank you to everyone who volunteered. That is a blessing of the light beyond anything I could have imagined.
And also a special thank you to Dragon Mount for hosting us, Jason and Jennifer Liang, and all of the work that you do.
Jason for putting up with us.
I want to thank Brandon and Harriet and Maria and Alan and the Academy. And anyway, may you find water and shade.
Well, I want to thank you guys for coming along with me with my little moraine side trip inspired by the new cover and my reread of New Spring. It's been fun. I don't think you can talk about moraine enough. It's no too much when it comes to moraine and Damodred. So thanks again. We appreciate it. And this is Virginia, saying may the light illumine you till we meet again.
And for myself, Andrew Gellis, and everyone here at the Fourth Age, Sodapian Into Manchima, Daichi Day.
Anyway,
not anymore.
That's true.
Actually, this is one of the weird things that I could have probably included that in our anniversary show. There was a time when it was Jason, myself, Carrie, and Ben, in which we were trying to experiment with ways of, you know, getting everybody into a more conversational and just easy flow. It had been said at one point that everybody make sure you have something to drink before and during, like, the pre-show talking, so that everybody would be relaxed by the time we started the podcast. And it never worked. It was like two or three of us were always really hopped up on caffeine because of the fact that it was like, we're going to fall asleep if we don't.
Oh, you mean there's... You mean they're serving wine with the podcast? Wait a minute. Somebody told me that.